Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we have a variety of topics. We're going to hear from the Academy of Ideas about scapegoating and the road to political persecution, and we're seeing that more and more every day. Also, John Perkins, an economic hitman, confesses and calls to action. Now, John was a person that would go in the 1960s and 70s, all over the world, and he would tell the rulers, the presidents of countries, here's gold and here's lead. The lead's the bullet. And if they didn't agree, then the jackals went in and assassinated these people. That's been going on for a long time, still going on now. So I think it's important that we realize, even though that he did this talk on TED in 2004, he is a person we should listen to because nothing has changed. In fact, no, this is 2016. So we're still doing the same thing. Also today, this is a really good speech. Rather than offering quick solutions to these very complex issues, Dr. Mate weaves together scientific research, case histories, and his own insights and experience to present a broad perspective that enlightens and empowers people to promote their own healing and that of those around them. And it's important. It's entitled, You're Not Going to Believe What I'm About to Tell You, and that's from The Oatmeal. Those are our topics today. I thought it would be nice to put a group of different issues that we're still facing today with positive solutions as well. Now to our program.
Humanity is arming itself in dread and fascinated horror for a stupendous crime. While we cannot create a heaven on earth, we can create a hell, and history is full of examples. Many of these man-made hells are the result of war and conquest, but many others are the result of governments persecuting their own people, be it the gulags of the Soviet Union, the killing fields of Cambodia, the Nazi concentration camps, the genocide of the Tutsis in Rwanda, or the Cultural Revolution in China. Power-hungry political leaders are responsible for the deaths of millions of people in the 20th century. How much have we learned from these recent horrors? Could a modern democratic government commit a political persecution and kill a portion of its own population? In this video, we are going to explore how this risk is high in any society that is naive and sheepish enough to permit the rise of totalitarian rule. The totalitarian hell, writes Hannah Arendt, proves only that the power of man is greater than they ever dared to think, and that man can realize hellish fantasies without making the sky fall or the earth open. Totalitarian government is a modern phenomenon. It first emerged in the 20th century, and as Rod Dreher explains, a totalitarian society is one in which an ideology seeks to displace all prior traditions and institutions, with the goal of bringing all aspects of society under control of that ideology. A totalitarian state is one that aspires to nothing less than defining and controlling reality. To achieve its ideological ends, a totalitarian government mobilizes all the mechanisms of the state to exert a strict top-down control of the populace. A mass surveillance system is put in place, and all aspects of life become politicized. In the 20th century, Nazism was the ideology that drove totalitarianism in Germany. It was fascism in Italy, while in Asia and other parts of Europe it was communism. Today, a new totalitarian ideology appears to be taking root. This ideology is built on the belief that at current population levels, human beings are parasitic creatures, and if allowed to be free, will run roughshod over Mother Earth. Harmony can be returned to our planet, and ecological disaster averted, but only if certain politicians and bureaucrats are granted the power to control our lives. What to eat, what type of energy to use, where to work, how to spend one's recreation time, how many children to have, and where one travels. All these questions are to be answered by the totalitarian ruling class, not by free individuals planning their lives within the law and order of a free society. The controlling mind of the totalitarian, writes Charles Eisenstein, foresees a paradise in which every action and every object is monitored, labeled, and controlled. There will be no room for any bad thing to exist. Nothing and no one will be out of place. Will we in the modern world allow another group of sick minds the opportunity to remake society in the image of a deluded ideology? Will we permit the rise of totalitarian rule? If we do, the result will be the same as it was in the 20th century. Society will be destroyed, poverty will be the norm, and many people will be killed. To understand why every time totalitarianism is tried, it devolves into mass killings by the government in power, we must examine the mind of the totalitarian politician and bureaucrat. For when we understand the pathologies that afflict these individuals, it will be clear why totalitarians will drive society into ruin before abandoning course and admitting failure. A first characteristic of the politicians and bureaucrats who make up the totalitarian government is that they are deluded true believers in their ideology. They are convinced, in other words, that what they are trying to accomplish is for the good of humanity, and that society would be worse off absent their rule. The totalitarian mind is similar to the schizophrenic mind. It believes the web of delusions in which it is caught. It sticks to its ideological model of the world in the face of disconfirming evidence, and it tends to hate those who try to pierce its illusions. A second characteristic of totalitarians is that they hold a contemptuous view of the masses and see normal men and women as inferior and incapable of making good choices. For their own good, it follows, and for the good of Mother Earth, the masses must obey the government. Totalitarians also tend to view the masses as unneeded in such large numbers for the realization of their ideological aims, and so view whole segments of the populace as useless eaters who are overpopulating the world. Only where great masses are viewed as superfluous, wrote Arendt, is totalitarian rule at all possible. A further characteristic of totalitarians is their tendency to judge moral issues through a utilitarian lens. When making policy decisions, in other words, totalitarians tend to use the criteria of the greatest good for the greatest number of people as the justification for their actions. Individual rights matter little to the utilitarian. What matters is the good of the collective, and to the totalitarian, the good of the collective always means achieving its ideological ends. This utilitarian approach to moral issues is reflective of a very disturbed mind, or as Ian McGilchrist explains, the tendency to adopt a calculating and utilitarian approach in judging moral issues is more marked in those with reduced aversion to harming others, lower trait empathy, higher psychoticism, which is itself characterized by reduced empathy and emotional blunting, and greater Machiavellianism. It is also characteristic of the moral thinking of psychopaths. A deluded true believer in a utopian ideology, viewing him or herself as a superior being, seeing the world as overpopulated, and judging moral issues through a utilitarian lens, such is the mind of a totalitarian, and such is a mind capable of committing a mass atrocity. After totalitarians have taken power, all that is needed to initiate the process of political persecution is the inevitable failure of their rule. And fail they will, as all attempts to control society in a strict top-down manner are doomed from the start. The more order the totalitarians try to impose on a society, the more chaos they create. And with such chaos comes a never-ending series of crises. But when the crises come, instead of admitting that the fault lies with their rule, totalitarians deflect blame to others through the process of scapegoating. For as true believers, totalitarians never consider the possibility that the crisis is a byproduct of trying to force a deluded ideology on society through top-down control. Rather, they convince themselves and strive to convince others that responsibility for the crisis lies elsewhere. Who is to be offered as the scapegoat? In the early stages of totalitarian rule, it is the non-believer or dissident who becomes the scapegoat for government failures. Such individuals are blamed for disseminating misinformation and sabotaging the ability of the government to fix the crisis. A quick utilitarian calculus will deem free speech expendable when the benefit, in the mind of the totalitarian, is quicker progress toward ideological aims. But this cracking down on free speech is but a preliminary step and a dangerous warning sign that a society is moving in the direction of a violent political persecution, for as Arthur Verslewis explains. Key to this transformation of the totalitarian into the role of a persecutor is a set of doctrines that one holds to be absolute or universal truth. Thus, everyone else is made into an unbeliever or a traitor. It is only a short step from this to the belief that one's duty is to impose the doctrines on everyone else, and that such an imposition is for their own good or for the good of society. From this point, it is not far to persecuting the recalcitrant and, in the frenzy of persecution, only a small further step to rationalize even mass murder under the guise of the greater good. To move from the mere silencing of dissidents to imprisoning and committing violence against them, totalitarians must turn them into what Hannah Arendt calls the objective enemy. The objective enemy is the ultimate scapegoat. These people are not guilty of any crimes, nor are they a threat to society. Rather, they are men and women whose way of life is incongruent with the totalitarian ideology. The objective enemy could be a certain ethnicity. They could be owners of private property in a communist country, or they could be the educated class, as in communist Cambodia, or as Arendt explains. The Jews in Nazi Germany, or the descendants of the former ruling classes in Soviet Russia, were not really suspected of any hostile action. They had been declared objective enemies of the regime in accordance with its ideology. The objective enemy is never an individual whose dangerous thoughts must be provoked or whose past justifies suspicion, but a carrier of tendencies, like the carrier of a disease. Rampant and repetitive propaganda is the tool used to create the objective enemy, and in this situation, words matter. For it is the terminology with which the objective enemy is branded that eventually convinces the totalitarians, and much of the public, that violence can legitimately be used against them. Or as Donald Dutton writes in his book, The Psychology of Genocide, a common perception of totalitarians is that their target group are vermin or a virus. As the crisis intensifies, so too will the propaganda used to demonize the objective enemy. The totalitarians will become increasingly desperate to deflect blame, and with free speech outlawed, those with sane and reasoned opinions will find it increasingly difficult to reveal the absurdity of the totalitarians' claims. The masses will be desperate as well, wanting to escape from the misery of a society deteriorating and an economy collapsing. They too will need someone to blame. If the propaganda is successful, the frustration of the masses will turn toward the objective enemy, and the ground will be paved for the ultimate crime to be committed. If the objective enemies are vermin, writes Arendt, it is logical that they should be killed by poison gas. If they are degenerate, they should not be allowed to contaminate the population. But it is not the ruling class who commits the violence against the objective enemy, but so-called normal men and women who occupy lower levels of government bureaucracies. How can these individuals commit such horrific crimes? And how can such a large segment of the population be convinced to support the political persecution, or at least to stand idly by and watch as innocent men and women are stripped of their rights, imprisoned, and then sent to an early grave? In the next video, we will explore these questions. The road to totalitarian domination, writes Arendt, leads through many intermediate stages. During this process, what common sense and normal people refuse to believe is that everything is possible.
I stood in front of the Shah of Iran, the presidents of Indonesia, Ecuador, Panama, members of the Royal House of Saudi Arabia, and I've said something like, in this hand, I have millions of dollars for you and your friends if you play our game. In this hand, I have a gun in case you decide not to. Now, my words were more diplomatic than that, but that was the message. I was an economic hitman. And we economic hitmen have created a new global economy, really, a form of capitalism that I call predatory capitalism. It isn't working. We all know this. The oceans are rising. The glaciers are melting. Less than 5% of us live here in the United States, and we consume almost 30% of the world's resources, while half the world is on the verge of starvation, or actually starving. That's not a model. China can't do it. India can't do it. They're trying, but they can't do it. We have to change. We have to have a revolution. We must change the system. I'll get into that in a minute, but first, how did I become an economic hitman? While I was still in business school, I was interviewed by the National Security Agency, the NSA. They put me through a series of extensive psychological tests, including on a lie detector. It's a long story, but to make a long story short, I ended up going in the Peace Corps and being sent deep into the Amazon rainforest. Now, I'd grown up the son of a teacher in a boys' prep school for very wealthy boys in rural New Hampshire. I grew up with lots of snow and cold, kind of like here in the winter, you know? And suddenly I find myself living in a thatched roof hut in the steamy jungle. You think I adjusted easily to that? After the Peace Corps, I then took a job. I was given a job as an economist at an international consulting firm in Boston with close ties to the NSA and the CIA. I was trained by a woman named Claudine Martin, whose job it was to train me to be an economic hitman. Now, Claudine had seen my NSA files. She knew that I wanted three things that I thought all my prep school buddies, the rich kids, had had: money, power, and sex. Claudine was really good at her job, and she promised me the first two. Money and power. And she taught me quite a bit about the third. And then she told me what my job would entail. I would go to countries with resources our corporations covet, like oil. I'd arrange a huge loan to those countries from the World Bank or its sister organizations, but the money wouldn't actually go to the country. It would go to our corporations, Bechtel, Halliburton, Brown & Root, familiar names, to build big infrastructure projects in those countries and incidentally make huge profits in the process. They'd build power plants and industrial parks, things that would benefit a few wealthy families in the country, the ones that own the industries. But the majority of the people would suffer. They would be left holding a huge debt they couldn't repay. So we'd go back and say, since you can't pay your debt, sell your resource, oil or whatever, real cheap to our corporations. Privatize. Sell your utilities, your schools, your jails, everything like that to our corporations. And Claudine also told me that if the leaders of these countries refused my offer, people she called jackals would be right behind me. I didn't actually carry a gun, but the jackals did. My first assignment was in Indonesia, a country that had just ended a terrible civil war where more than 1 million people had been killed. It had a terrifying reputation. And I have to admit that when I arrived in Jakarta, knowing I'd be there for about 3 years, my knees were shaking pretty bad. My stomach was filled with fluttering butterflies. I had no idea what I was supposed to do. I was a very young man. I just knew that I was expected to produce a report that would convince the Indonesian government to build an extremely expensive electrical system, hiring our corporations to do it. Claudine had made it sound simple, even kind of James Bondishly romantic. But now I'm struck by reality, and I felt naive, ill-prepared, vulnerable. Fortunately for me, the winner of the Civil War, President Suharto, who was actually a dictator, wanted the projects that I was offering, and he also wanted CIA and Pentagon protection. And so every time I stumbled, and I stumbled often, Somebody was there to pick me up. A government official would appear with an incredible report that would indicate beyond any shadow of a doubt that electricity was all the country needed to take off to huge growth. A Harvard-trained mathematician showed up with a mathematical formula that proved that if they just built this electrical system, everything would be fine. In the end, I produced a report that forecasts the need for electricity at an unheard of annual rate of 19%. Indonesia got its loan. Our corporations made lots of money. And I was promoted from economist to chief economist. It was quite a lesson. At that time, the Cold War was just really, really revving up. And Washington believed that Cuba was about to spread communism throughout the hemisphere. The CIA developed a program called Operation Condor to support right-wing dictatorships in Brazil, Argentina, Chile, throughout the continent. Jaime Roldós, president of Ecuador, democratically elected, and Omar Torrijos, head of state of Panama, strongly opposed Operation Condor. I was sent down to get them to change their ways. They wouldn't. They refused. Roldós was killed when his private plane crashed in what many believe was not an accident. Torrijos said, "If CIA killed my friend Jaime, I'll probably be next." In less than 3 months, he died when his private plane crashed under very similar circumstances. You're gonna hear after the break from a Marine Corps general who was in Panama at the time, and he agrees with me that these were probably, at least Torrijos was probably assassination. We don't really know who caused it. And I want to say that I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't believe in some overarching conspiracy to take over the world. But I do read reports. I think I'm a conspiracy factualist. You know, I read this recently declassified information, the CIA's own website, where they admit that the US government was deeply involved in the overthrow or assassination of Prime Minister Mossadegh of Iran, President Allende of Chile, Arbenz of Guatemala, Diem of Vietnam, Lumumba of the Congo. And speaking of Allende of Chile, he was replaced by the terribly brutal dictator General Pinochet, who was a great defender of Operation Condor and also oversaw the murder of tens of thousands of his people, and was praised by Secretary of State Henry Kissinger as a great defender of capitalism. I believe in national security, and I don't believe that US security is served. I believe it's jeopardized when our agencies overthrow or assassinate the leaders of other countries because they don't follow our policies. I'm a capitalist. I think that capitalism has given us incredible technology, art, science, medicine. And I think it holds out the hope for the future. But there's this new form of capitalism that I call predatory capitalism that's the enemy of true capitalism. Let me explain. When I was in business school, I was taught that a good CEO makes a decent rate of return for his company and also makes sure his company is a good citizen. He pays his workers a fair wage, gives them health insurance and retirement pensions, pays taxes, imagine that, and supports local school and recreational facilities and so on and so forth. And in essence, he makes sure that his company serves the public interest. That all changed in 1976 when Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and stated, amongst many other things, the only responsibility of business is to maximize profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. It changed everything. And it has created this global fiasco, what I believe we're headed toward this disaster, where we're in it a lot now with the climate change, with all the things that we all know is happening, and we must change that. And we can change that. How? I think the American Revolution actually offers an interesting example. Back in 1773, Most everybody in the United States believed that the British were invincible. But George Washington stepped forward, and he remembered 20 years earlier during the French and Indian War, he had witnessed at the Battle of the Monongahela, the defeat of a huge, powerful British army by a handful of Indians. And Washington said, they're not invincible. All we got to do is hide behind trees. Change the rules. So I think that's where we're at today. Change the rules. I like the rules I learned in business school, that a good corporation, a good CEO, should make sure that his corporation serves a public interest, is a good citizen. I like the idea that you and I should invest in corporations that instead of essentially destroying the resources upon which our economy is based, instead of doing that, they clean up pollution, regenerate destroyed environments, develop new technologies for more efficient energy, transportation, communications, and just about everything else. In essence, let's get our corporations to create an economic system that is itself a renewable resource. Are you ready to do that? Yes, I think we're all ready. We can create this renewable resource so our corporations today really run the world. They control most of the politics in this country and just about everywhere else. But it's important to remember that they need us. We work for them, we manage them, many of you own them, you run them. They depend on us to buy their goods and services, to invest in them, to work for them, to support them through our tax dollars. We have the power. You have the power. Earlier, we heard this incredible music about our passion and our power. Let's put our passion to work. This brings us to you. What is it you can do, each and every one of you? What can we all do? Well, I think perhaps the most important thing to start off by saying is that we are living at a time in history when the individual, you, has more power than ever before. I travel a great deal around the world, speaking at events like this and many others. And everywhere I go, whether it's in Asia or Africa, South America, Europe, Middle East, the United States, people are waking up to the fact that we live on a very tiny, fragile space station with no shuttles. And it's headed for disaster, and we got to turn it around. We can do it. So in my latest book, which is for sale out here, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I have a whole section devoted to what you can do, lists and ideas. But I want to just mention three of them here today, kind of in summary. So remembering that we have this power today, especially with the internet. Number one, search out and spread, shine a light on the story behind the story. I think my life as an economic hitman highlights the fact that there's almost always a story behind the story. And recently, revelations such as WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden papers and the Panama papers and reporting by amazing bloggers and others, the Pulitzer Prize-winning ProPublica, Common Dreams, many, many organizations out there are shining a light on the fact that we have corrupt politicians. We have tax-evading billionaires. You know, democracy depends upon transparency. It depends on understanding the story behind the story. It demands that you and I look for the story. It demands that we question our leaders and our government policies. That's the patriotic thing to do. So number one, look for, spread the story behind the story. Number two, use local, individual, and community power, your power, to change politics, to change the governmental system, to change the laws. We the people must do it. We can't wait for a president to do it, whoever the next president is. We have to do it, and that's our job in a democracy, to do that. Recently, the small state of Vermont, with less than 0.2% of the US population, a tiny group of people in that small state, got laws passed that forced corporations to label GMOs. As a result, five of the major food companies, ConAgra, General Mills, Kellogg's, Campbell Soup, Mars, all committed to labeling GMOs here in Michigan and everywhere else in the United States. And I just recently heard Hugh Grant, not the actor, but the CEO of Monsanto, on the radio saying that that's impacting him hugely. Monsanto's going to have to reevaluate its attitude to GMOs because of what happened in the state of Vermont. We, the people, have forced the corporate corporations to end apartheid in South Africa, to clean up polluted rivers, pass laws to make that happen, to open their doors wider to women and minorities. You, we have the power, the movement to amend now, to get big money out of politics. That's very important. So, number two, join an organization or start one that impacts local laws, national laws, global laws. Do it. Get involved, please. This is something important that we all can do. And number three, help a corporation understand that it must serve a public interest. Corporations listen to you. CEOs, I know lots of CEOs of very powerful corporations. They know if they're getting flooded by emails, tweets, or Facebook, whatever. They know, and they have to respond. So I suggest to you, pick a corporation, any corporation that appeals to you. Send them an email. Don't make them the enemy. Say, I love you, I love your product, but I'm not going to buy it anymore until you stop polluting or clean up pollution or pay your workers a fair wage or whatever your issue is. Send that email to the corporation and to all your social networking circles and ask them to send it to all their social networking circles. Get involved. So shine a light, change the laws, and convince corporations to serve a public interest. And in that way, we're going to turn this economic system that is failing us, one that's exhausted, one that's devastating its own resource base, into a renewable resource. I think you and I live at the most amazing, important time in human history. We are going through a revolution, a consciousness revolution. People are waking up across the planet. Together, we're going to come together and we're going to create a world that my 8-year-old grandson and every other child of every sentient being on this planet is going to look back at and say, hey, thank God for TEDx in Michigan. Thank God all those people came together and committed to moving forward to creating an economic system that's a renewable resource. Thank you all for being here. I look forward to taking this journey with you. Thank you so very much. Thank you. Thank you.
When we look around this society and from the perspective of health, what do we see? We see that 50% of adults in this society, which considers itself the most successful society in the history of the world, actually suffers of some chronic illness, heart disease, high blood pressure, cancer, whatever, autoimmune disease, whatever it happens to be. 50% of adolescents today are now set to meet the diagnostic criteria for one or another mental health condition. There are 3.5 million children in this country who are receiving stimulant medications for ADHD. In the United States, the antipsychotics, risperidone and Seroquel, I think are in the top four to six prescriptions given out in this country, not to mention the antidepressants. But if we understand that human beings' physiology is affected by their relationships, then we see that when stress happens, cortisol elevates in the body, which is a stress hormone, which suppresses the immune system. Adrenaline increases in the body, which disorganizes the nervous system. In the short term, they help you fight back or to escape, but in the long term, they actually can suppress the body. No wonder then that people are isolated and stressed are more likely to develop disease, which is to say that the disease is not simply a manifestation of some physical process unique to them, but it reflects their particular lives in a particular environment, in a particular culture. So when I talk about the toxic culture that a materialistic society offers its members, what am I referring to? Well, materialism is really a system of belief or behavior which considers material things, and particularly the control and possession of material things, as more important than human values such as connection, love, or spiritual values such as recognizing the unity of everything. And that's the kind of culture we live in. Interestingly enough, the religious right, in their opposition to the very idea of climate change, or to the idea that the environment is important to look at, they will quote the Old Testament where man is given stewardship over the earth and all other creatures. But when they talk about stewardship, they mean control and dominance. There's another way to look at stewardship, which is caring and nurturing for, looking after. And in the materialistic sense, it's that control and ownership that we look at. And that means that the culture itself, quite apart from the physical toxins that we spew into the environment and the way in which we're altering the very air that we breathe and the very sun that beats down on us, we actually are affected also by the toxicity of human relationships or the lack of human relationships that this kind of a society that emphasizes material values teaches us to pursue. And from that perspective, we have to understand that medicine is not simply a science. It's much more than that. It's also an ideology. It's a way of looking at human beings. So when we look at human beings as individuals without understanding the importance of their social relationships and their emotional, psychological interactions with others, that's actually a manifestation of the individualistic perspective of the entrepreneur who says that only I matter and what I gain or what I control matters, and we're all in competition with one another. So you see that economic ideological perspective also showing up in its own particular way in the practice of medicine. Well, reality is totally different. Reality tells us that we can't be separated, and this begins already in pregnancy. So a study out of Johns Hopkins University in 2004, for example, showed that the reactivity to stress of the fetus is affected by the stress, depression, or anxiety of the mother. So when you look at the heartbeat and the movement of infants in the womb whose mothers are stressed, depressed, or anxious, you see different patterns of activity, and that will have lifetime effects. So this mind-body unity and this interaction of the environment and the individual begins already in the womb. A report out of Harvard earlier this year talked about the impact of toxic stress on children. And these children who experienced toxic stress on the part on because the environment was stressed, because their parents were highly stressed, or dysfunctional, or abusive, later on in life, there was significantly increased risk of heart disease, obesity, diabetes mellitus, high blood pressure, and a whole list of other medical conditions. And from that same perspective again, when we look at something like the obesity epidemic, which has 30% of kids in the United States overweight now, significantly overweight, it's not a food problem. Well, it is a food problem, the junk foods and all that, but it's mostly a stress problem, because what people do is they soothe their stresses, like any addiction. They soothe their stresses with their addictive behaviors. And those junk foods work in the short term because they release feel-good hormones in the brain. So if you want to look at children and prevent obesity, it's not enough to tell them not to eat junk foods or to get more exercise. You have to say, what's lacking in their lives that they're so stressed, that they have to soothe themselves in that particular way? And what's lacking in their lives, of course, are human relationships that are nurturing and supportive. Again, not because the parents are not trying to do their best, but because the parents are trying to do their best under impossible circumstances. If you look at what actually triggers stress, the significant factors that trigger stress are uncertainty, lack of information, and loss of control. Now, what happens in a culture where the economy is going on a tube, where decisions are made far away by people who don't even know you and you don't know who they are? And your life is very much affected by these large forces over which you have increasingly a sense that you have no control or even influence over. Well, that means a lot of people are going to be stressed, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of people are going to be stressed. And that stress then will lead to addictive behaviors. That stress then will lead to parents passing that stress on to their children. In the 19th century, Karl Marx talked about alienation, which is a separation, being a stranger to something. And you're an alien to something. And Marx said there were four alienations in this culture. One is alienated from nature. At a conference dedicated to looking at the physical and the natural environment, I don't have to say much to you to show how alienated we are from nature when we're destroying nature itself. The second alienation is from other people. And that means we have less contact, we have less intimacy, we have less trust, we have less of a sense of relationship. And that, of course, as I've shown you, leads to increased propensity to illness, physical and mental. We are alienated from our work. A lot of people no longer do work that has any meaning to them. And that means that, and since human beings are productive creatures, we really are created in the image of God. We're meant to create. When we do work that's not creative, that doesn't reflect who we are, that imposes depression, anxiety, a sense of meaninglessness. And when we have a sense of meaninglessness, we'll want to substitute that sense of meaninglessness or that sense of meaning that we've lost by all kinds of other activities. And then we get all hung up on how we look, or how people feel about us, what we can obtain, what we can possess, what successes we can achieve. In other words, all the false substitutes which cannot possibly compensate us for the lack of genuine meaning. Finally, and most importantly, we become alienated from ourselves. How many of you had the following experience? That you had a powerful gut feeling about something, you didn't pay attention to it, and you were sorry afterwards. Well, that means to say, now you know what you're telling me? You're telling me that at some point in your childhood, you got separated from yourself. Because no infant is born without gut feelings. Infants are totally connected to their gut feelings. That in this culture, something very powerful happens to alienate you from your true self because the world couldn't stand who you really were. And your parents were too stressed themselves to honor and recognize who you really were. Just as a parent, I did that to my kids without meaning to. And then we become alienated from ourselves, we shut down our gut feelings, and our gut feelings are not luxuries, you know. They tell us what is right and what is wrong. They tell us what is dangerous and what is friendly. They tell us what is safe and what is dangerous. And they tell us what is true and what is false. So when we're alienated from our gut feelings, we have no longer have a sense of reality, no longer a sense of truth. Well, the good news is that human beings can regain their sense of connection to themselves, just as we can regain our sense of connection to our nature. And empathy, which is a genuine human quality, is in us. We're actually wired for empathy. That's our nature as human beings. So contrary to the myth in our culture that we're separated, individual, aggressive, competitive creatures, we're actually wired for empathy, wired for connection, wired for love, wired for compassion. So really, to move forward, all we have to do All we have to do, not an easy task, but it's certainly available to us, is to get back to our true nature. Thank you.
Stop. Wait. You're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you. I'm going to tell you some things. You're not going to believe these things I tell you. And that's okay. You have good reason not to. But I need you to keep listening, regardless of what you believe. I don't care if you're liberal, conservative, or somewhere in between. I don't care if you're a cat person, a dog person, or a tarantula person, morning person or night owl, iPhone, Android, Coke, or Pepsi, I don't care. All I care about is that you read this to the end. Sound good? Then let's begin. You may have heard that George Washington had wooden teeth. He lost most of his teeth in his 20s and had a set of dentures made out of wood. It's a disturbing visual. The founding father, commander-in-chief, and first president of the United States click-clacking his way through a ham sandwich. Except it isn't true. In 2005, at the National Museum of Dentistry in Baltimore, laser scans were performed on Washington's 200-year-old dentures and found them to be made of gold, lead, hippopotamus ivory, horse, and donkey teeth. His mouth was a petting zoo of nightmares. Upon learning this information, I want to ask you something. How did it feel to learn this new fact about George Washington's teeth? I stated a thing, I provided evidence of that thing, and presumably you now believe the thing I stated. Presumably, your belief in the composition of George Washington's teeth has changed with little or no friction. Presumably, the next time you're at a party and George Washington's teeth come up in conversation, you're going to proudly impart this newfound knowledge to your fellow partygoers. Yes? Terrific, let's continue. What if I told you George Washington had another set of false teeth? What if I told you the other set wasn't made from wood, ivory, or any of the aforementioned materials? What if I told you it was made from the teeth of slaves? Now, let's try this again. How did it feel to learn this fact about George Washington? Any more of that friction I mentioned earlier? Before we go any further, allow me to reiterate. I am not here to convince you that George Washington was a bad person. I could go through all my cited sources and cherry-pick arguments that either deify or demonize George Washington. I could paint a portrait of a monster, or I could exonerate a patriot. But as I said before, I don't care. It's not the point. The point is to give you an emotional barometer of how you feel when presented with new ideas. Because you may have noticed that the first fact about George Washington's teeth was rather easy to accept. I would even wager that when I told you the first fact, you accepted it without question. But when I told you the second fact, you immediately checked my sources and are now furiously composing an informed yet incendiary retort which you will boldly deliver to me in the form of a sour, blustering Facebook comment. And that's okay. That's all part of it. Let's try a few more. Napoleon Bonaparte was not short. He was 5'7", which is taller than the average Frenchman of the time. Thomas Crapper did not invent the flush toilet, nor did the word crap come about because of his name. Houseflies live for about a month, not 24 hours. Humans don't explode in a vacuum, nor do we boil. We just pass out from lack of oxygen and then we die. Again, as you read these facts, take stock of how you feel. I'm guessing you softened to the last few fairly easily. Let's try a few more and then we're done. There is zero evidence that Jesus Christ was born on December 25th. The Pledge of Allegiance was written by a socialist. 6 of the 7 justices who voted in favor of Roe v. Wade were Republican appointed. How'd those last 3 feel? Depending on your beliefs, I'm guessing it may have put some of you about here. At the very least, you can concede that it felt different to hear those statements compared to the ones about Napoleon or houseflies. Yes? But why? Why do we easily soften to some ideas but not to others? Why do we gnash our teeth when presented with evidence counter to our beliefs? Why do we not only ignore this evidence, but dig our heels in deeper and believe more strongly in the opposing argument? Why would providing more evidence make someone less likely to believe in an idea? It seems backwards and bat-bum crazy bonkers to me. It turns out bat-bum crazy bonkers is a name in the world of neuroscience. It's called the backfire effect, and it's a well-documented psychological behavior. A few years ago at the University of Southern California's Brain and Creativity Institute, a study was conducted where participants were placed into an MRI machine. Once inside, they were presented with counterarguments to strongly held political beliefs. A few examples. Laws restricting gun ownership should be made more restrictive. Gay marriage should not be legalized. As participants were read these counterarguments, various parts of their brains were scanned for activity. What the study revealed was that the part of the brain that responds to a physical threat also responds to an intellectual one. This area of the brain is known as the amygdala, and is the emotional core of your mind. Unfortunately, it makes us biologically wired to react to threatening information the same way we'd react to being attacked by a predator. From an evolutionary standpoint, it makes sense. If you were a caveman and another caveman threw a boulder at your head, you wouldn't react biologically debating the pros and cons of getting brained. Core beliefs are the beliefs which people cherish the most deeply. They usually develop from childhood and are compounded by life experiences. Core beliefs are inflexible, rigid, and incredibly sensitive to being challenged. When I told you that George Washington's dentures were made from animal bones, it probably didn't ruffle many feathers. But when I suggested they were made from slave teeth, I'm guessing it caused strife with some of you. There are obvious cultural reasons for this. Slavery is a sensitive, hot-button issue. But there are biological reasons as well. The amygdala of your brain is screaming, "Battle stations!" Some of you may have held a worldview that George Washington was a patriot and a hero. By presenting negative information about him, it challenged that worldview. Your brain loves consistency. It builds a worldview like we build a house. It has a foundation and a frame and windows and doors, and it knows exactly how everything fits together. If a new piece is introduced and it doesn't fit, the whole house falls apart. Your brain protects you by rejecting that piece. It then builds a fence and a moat and refuses to let in any visitors. This is why we have the backfire effect. It's a biological way of protecting a worldview. Just remember that your worldview isn't a perfect house that was built to last forever. It's a cheap condo, and over time most of it will fall apart. So, what do we do about this? Some of you have probably been nodding along in agreement, waiting for me to deliver a series of clever, combative ways to offset the backfire effect. The disappointing truth is that I don't have much advice for you. I don't have a way to change the behavior of 7.5 billion people carrying their beliefs around like precious gems wrapped in hand grenades. Sure, there are ways of changing people's minds that are more effective than others, but ultimately, they all fall short. This is compounded by the internet, where anything can be cited as a source and every disagreement degrades into a room full of orangutans throwing feces at one another. The best I can do is make you aware of it, so you can identify the backfire effect in your own brain. Which isn't easy. The mind can't separate the emotional cortex from the logical one, and one could argue that this emotional underbelly is what makes us human. But I would argue that it's also what makes us animals. I sometimes pretend the amygdala of my brain is my pinky toe. When a core belief is challenged, I imagine it yelling insane things at me. I let it yell. I let it have its moment. I let the emotional cortex fight its little fight, and then I listen, and then I change. Because this universe of ours is so achingly beautiful, and in it together, we're all going the same direction. I'm not here to take control of the wheel or tell you what to believe. I'm just here to tell you that it's okay to stop, to listen, to change.
It's not important whether we agree or disagree in total or part to anything anyone is saying. It's important that we have an open, honest discussion on issues. Let people present themselves. And if I disagree with something, it doesn't mean I disagree with everything. There may be something that a person is sharing that is important, but we have to listen from a neutral perspective. And that's very hard, since there's so many biases hardwired into us to our life experiences and those we've come into contact with and those that we believe. But what if what we believe is wrong? And today, there's some good arguments being made about many of the things in medicine, in science, in finance, in agriculture, that is simply wrong. And yet because the most powerful and respected people in their fields are mouthing these deceptions, half-truths, and full lies, people don't argue with the issue, and they should. That's what the Progressive Commentary is about. So I want to thank you all for listening. Go to GaryNall.com, and you can see all of our Progressive Commentary hours over the years, over the decades. Have a nice day, everyone.